Hello, everybody.
I'm Phil Margavichus, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website at www.projectmedtech.com and follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching Funding MedTech on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. Funding MedTech is an interview-style podcast focused on exploring ways to fund MedTech innovation and will be released weekly on Wednesdays. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Inalytics. Do you want to submit your software MVP to the FDA in 4 months? Perhaps you're looking for an FDA-savvy software development partner to write your software or to build your AI/ML algorithm from the ground up. Today's sponsor, Inalytics, can take your software idea, build it, clear it, deploy it, and maintain it. They can be your Sherpa to help you climb the FDA submission hurdle in as little as 4 months, and that includes the clinical performance study. What are you waiting for? Get on the market before your competition and go check out Inalytics.com. That's Inalytics.com. Or reach out to the founders, Yujan Shrestha or David Giese on LinkedIn. In this episode, Michelle Lott at Leonara QA and Dwayne Mantini discuss the QMSR FDA e-startup program, 513G versus pre-submission meeting, MDR update, and so much more.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Michelle, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me again.
Absolutely. So Michelle was on episode 71 of the Project MedTech podcast. For those listening in, you can always go back and check that out. And then also one of Michelle's partners at Leonara QA, Ty Benson, was episode 110 of the podcast too. So there's quite a bit of information there on Leonara QA, but we wanted to have Michelle back on to kind of just get the industry trend with what's going on with the FDA currently. We kind of talked about a few in our prep call. We talked a little bit about some of the different areas we wanted to touch on, Michelle, and one of those being the QMSR with the FDA. Do you want to expand on what that is, what that means, and we can go from there?
Sure. The QMSR is it stands for the Quality Management System Regulation, which is replacing the current QSR or Quality System Regulation. So it doesn't sound like much of a change by just adding the word management in, but if you have a quality management system that's compliant with the QSR only, it's going to be quite the transition for the U.S. manufacturers.
Okay, so if you're a new company coming to market, Michelle, you have to comply with this new update, right? So theoretically, it wouldn't make too big of a difference for you, but if you already have a product on the market, there's some significant updates. And what are the differences, I guess? Yeah.
Yeah. So the QMSR was released February of 2024, so just almost 2 months ago now. And it had been in the works since 1996, and I'll go into that history a little bit more. But it's going to go into effect in 2020. It's going to go into effect 2026. So the QSR will be 50 when it sunsets. So yes, if you're bringing a new product to market, you need to just go ahead and comply with the full QMSR. Because as soon as you get your quality system implemented, you're going to be turning around and having to update it by 2026 again. So the problem will be twofold. People who are selling in the U.S. only that already have a product on the market, and then people who might have been working on bringing a product to the market for a while and had been maybe financially, resource planning, et cetera, been planning on complying with the QMSR instead of like an ISO 13485 based quality management system.
Got it. And I guess, you know, what are some of the, for any time, you know, we tell the companies we're working with, at least, that, hey, there's some new thing they need to comply with. The question is, well, great. How much more expensive is it going to be now for me to do this? So I guess from your side of things, is it adding a significant barrier? Is there some additional cost? Is in the long run, you know, is it going to make it better? You know, I guess in a lot of the cases that I've seen, for people who've already had something, yeah, there's some additional cost to now comply with this, but generally it kind of comes out in the wash because you have a better quality product or something like this. So I'm just curious on your side, how you're looking at it.
So the big difference for the QMSR is that it's moved towards harmonization with ISO 13485. So now there are more and different procedures required at a different level of detail. And this is one of the biggest changes under the QSR. Records like internal audit, supplier audit, and management review were not privy to FDA inspection. And now under the QMSR, they are. So that has like an immediate upfront cost because the scope of your quality management system needs to be expanded. But then it has a cost over the long run because there are additional activities, different ways to approach things, different records that are going to be audited that you need to invest more and better quality resources into over the long run. But, you know, most significantly is that most people who were pursuing U.S. only markets were doing so partly because of the cost of an ISO 13485 or medical device single audit program certificate. But now if you, so you still don't have to have a certificate, but should you pursue the medical device single audit program, in that case, the audit organization sends your audit report to the FDA. The FDA will inspect the report, and if the report is satisfactory, they will usually choose not to inspect your facility themselves. Well, if you're going to do the medical device single audit program for the U.S., you might as well do it for Canada. And so now the Canadian market might be open to you, whereas before you wouldn't have pursued it because to get into Canada, you've had to have a MDSAP certificate for years. So now there is a larger global perspective that did not make sense before the QMSR that might now financially make sense if you're having to go through these extra links, and it could save you not only inspection by the FDA, but open these doors to these five other countries or four other countries besides the US that MDSAP participates in.
Yeah, I think that's very exciting for companies, especially, you know, to be thinking about it early on so that you can think about, you know, where else they may want to commercialize the product. I think that's big, and that kind of strategy is really important. If someone wanted to kind of get more information on this, Michelle, besides what we just talked about now, like actually see some of this documentation, I'm guessing this is on the FDA's website somewhere, and there's some maybe guidance documents around this or what?
The guidance documents have not come out yet. Yes, there will be a landing page on the FDA, but also I have got an hour-long video on YouTube on the QMSR masterclass that goes through in detail the major differences between 1345 and the QMSR and what they need to plan for.
Perfect. And so for those who are listening in, if you just go to youtube.com and put LeanRA QA in, their YouTube page will come up and you can kind of see all of this on there. It's actually, for me, it's the second video in that you posted 2 weeks ago. So very cool. Super helpful. Great. What about one of the other hot topics we had was the eStar program and the evolution of that. for those who don't know what the eSTAR program is, maybe define that first and then kind of go into some of the updates we just recently saw.
Yep. So eSTAR is this buildable PDF form template that is, it's one of those dynamic forms that kind of, you make certain selections and then it kind of starts pre-populating other sections of the template. This is a program that the FDA came up with some years ago, but and has been piloting and made it volunteer. Well, effective October of 2023, they made it mandatory for 510Ks. And along the way, they have also included de novo. They have included pre-market approvals. They've included pre-subs. And just recently, they released 513Gs in the eSTAR. Now, everything but 510K is still voluntary, but you know, you can see the writing on the wall is going to all submissions with the FDA are going to eventually be mandatory in this eSTAR.
Cool. I'm guessing this makes it more streamlined then, from like an application perspective and maybe less, not ambiguous, but less like esoteric maybe from,
yes,
you know, person to person. Is that kind of the thought process here?
In general, yes. The streamlining mainly comes on the FDA review side because the template kind of fits into the internal FDA review templates. So there's kind of like less, I guess, transcription, if you will, that they have to do in to prepare their review. But and I think for industry, it has a lot of strengths and weaknesses. But one of the biggest strengths, to your point about making it less esoteric, is that it has a ton of help text in it that points you towards, you know, guidance documents or, hey, if you make this particular classification of biocompatibility, we are going to interpret it this way. And so, you know, don't even bother with the biocompatibility if you've not interpreted it that way and thus done the coordinating testing.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. And then with this eSTAR program, does this kind of like, if you, let's say I did a pre-sub with the FDA, I got back, I decided, okay, I'm going to open up this eSTAR program. Is this like a thing I can kind of start and stop, fill out? And like, how does that work, I guess? Or should you have pretty much everything ready to go when you go in to start filling that program out?
You technically can, but it's not efficient to do that way because of the limitations in the template. We still work in Word templates. We review, edit, share, collaborate, and then when we get the go-ahead for a section, then we will populate that after we have everything that we need and we're sure nothing's going to change. And the reason for that is say, like the text box where you have to enter, say, the device description, that text box will only show you four lines of text at a time. Well, a device description might be pages long. And so you can only read four lines at a time, and then you're scrolling. So it's not very user-friendly. The template is very slow, so you're going to do a lot of copy, paste, and sit and wait. And there's just a lot of waiting in the template, so it's just not very efficient to kind of move in and out, especially if you need people to review and collaborate.
Gotcha. Okay. So while it is nice, it is new, there still are some glitches with it and inefficiencies. Real quick, before we move over to the pre-sub piece of this, the 513G, you said that's part of the QSTAR program now. Help me understand situations, because there are some regulatory consultants that I talk to, and I probably fall in this camp, but there also could be something I'm missing that would always, like, pretty much exclusively recommend a pre-sub over a 513G, like 90% of the time. First of all, what's your opinion? And then also, when is it appropriate to say, hey, this actually is a really good fit for a 513G and maybe not a pre-sub?
Well, unfortunately, that line is getting increasingly blurred as we are seeing a lot of turnover post-COVID with the FDA. So just from a resource perspective, to set some context for this challenge, a lot of the resources, the senior resources that understood the processes, understood the differences, had a consistent interpretation of the guidance document about when to do a pre-sub and when to do a 513G, they retired. And so that's left a lot of younger people and people who maybe graduated with their master's or PhDs, got a job at the FDA right off the bat instead of in industry. So they've also never had to do these things. So you've got new people interpreting these guidance documents for themselves without that senior management context anymore. And so we're getting super inconsistent feedback. And there's rarely a pre-sub where the FDA will answer most of our questions to a point, but then they say, well, if you want to know this, you really need to do a 513G. And they're doing this, and people need to know there's a guidance document out there about the Q submission process that specifies the types of questions that are appropriate. It's not an exhaustive list, but it says these questions will lead to a productive discussion in a QSA. 513Gs are a request for classification, meaning we don't know what this is. That's when you should do a 513G. But they are starting to, I've done 513Gs where they've said you should do a pre-sub, even when I use the exact questions from the guidance document. So it's, you know, it's anybody's game right now.
Understood. Yeah, this is something that's really interesting because, Project MedTech, we don't do any kind of like regulatory process or anything. We kind of help with making sure your regulatory strategy integrates to this business plan we're helping build. And we've been seeing quite a few where they're like, oh, we recommend doing a 513G. Some of these regulatory consultants, and I'm like, man, like we never would have recommended that in 2019. And so I was curious, what is with this kind of change? Because certainly they're seeing something that's leading them to say, hey, you should do this over this. So really appreciate
you
the
know,
insight.
Think about it from their resource logistics perspective. Pre-submissions during COVID, as soon as, you know, everybody and their mother that invented a product figured out that they could have this conversation with FDA for free, the number of pre-submissions shot through the roof about products that were never going to go anywhere, developed by people who had never been in medical devices before and didn't really know what they were doing. And so, and pre-subs are free. There's no fee. There is a clock, though, that the FDA watches. 513Gs have a fee, and they don't really have a clock. So the FDA's metrics don't hold them accountable. They will say that you're going to 60 to 75 days like a pre-sub, but it's not going against their internal metrics. I have not gotten a 513G back in less than 6 months. Most of them have pushed 10 months to even a year.
Whoa. Wow. So good to know because, That was always the piece of it too, was I thought maybe the 513G had some quick turnaround time, right? Because you're paying for it. So not only does it cost money, but it's potentially delayed because the FDA is not measured on their response time there. That's crucial to know. And I think, honestly, this wasn't one of our topics. It was just something that like I've seen recently I wanted to pick your brain on, but I'm glad we talked about this because that is big for startup companies. This is good to know. Yeah. Okay. So transitioning right into the pre-sub piece of this, what are you kind of seeing with FDA pre-subs right now? Turnaround times. I think you kind of alluded to some things about getting questions answered and that sort of thing, but I guess kind of what else is going on there?
Mm-hmm. In terms of turnaround times, they've been pretty on the money with hitting their 60-day, or 5 days before a meeting, if you have a meeting. So that part has been pretty consistent. The feedback has been a little all over the place. And it's going to depend also on review divisions. I've asked certain questions of one review division. They answered them, very helpful. The other one said, do a 513G or do a step or whatever. We're not talking about that. And so again, we're back to, it's inconsistent among reviewers. It's inconsistent among review divisions. And then also, I've had the FDA tell me, we want you to copy and paste things from the guidance document. You use our words to tell us what you're asking in the pre-submission so that we don't have as much work to do. They even said as much work to do. So now you have to know the FDA better than the FDA. Then you have to tell the FDA about the FDA so that they know that they can agree with you. Does that make sense?
Not at all. Wow. Okay. All right. How's turnaround time? Like, are they hitting the 60 to 75 day mark? Or yep. Okay. Yeah, because they're measured by that.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about the types of meetings. So you know, you've got in person, you've got, you know, a virtual teleconference, and then you've got written feedback only. What are you seeing? I know what my preference is. What are you seeing for your clients that are doing pre-subs? How are they getting their feedback?
Yeah. I usually push for teleconference, but I was also used to going to them in person, right? Pre-COVID. Yeah, so we're seeing written feedback with the teleconference aspect of it, but I'm curious to what you're pushing for.
I usually recommend written feedback only.
Okay.
And the reason for that is that I have found that the feedback is more comprehensive. And it's the FDA writes it in their own words. So it's harder for them to argue with it later. You know, as opposed to the meeting minutes that you write, even though that they agree to them, those are still your words and your interpretation. So the answers are longer, they're more comprehensive. And then this is the part that I like about written feedback, is they go into detail about things that you might not have asked that reflect their current thinking. They might say, oh, you might also want to think about, you know, X, mm-hmm. Y, and Z. Or we have concerns about. And then if you've got questions, you can still ask for a clarification meeting. Now, you can't discuss anything new, and this is not like a teleconference. You can just say, I need to understand your thought behind
Gotcha. That
question or statement.
Yeah.
But whereas, you know, a written feedback, so that's why I like that. You know, I think that there's a lot of, can be a lot of subjectivity in the teleconference conversations.
On the written feedback piece, depending on what they say to you, can you ask further questions?
I have had both ways. So I have had, been able to informally, after getting a written feedback only, we had questions and I put them in an email and said, you know, can we have like a clarification meeting? And she sent me back an email that was as detailed as my written feedback only. So it was so helpful without having to have, you know, that additional. And so from there, then we went into a second pre-sub to have a verbal conversation. And that series of interactions was extremely productive.
Gotcha. Okay. That's helpful. Okay. Anything else on the FDA?
Those are the biggest hitters, you know, yeah. To look back to the QMSR, you know, if you really want to, the problem with the QMSR is not just the difference between the ISO 1345 and what is the QSR now, but it is the expectation of how the FDA is going to interpret that is still unknown. And in the comments to the QMSR, the preamble, if you will, the FDA says, well, if you were concerned about risk in 1345, when they say risk, even though we're not codifying 14971, if you want to know what we mean in 1345, you need to know on 14971. That's our expectation. Well, if you want to know also, we're not codifying the notes, but if you want to know what a particular subclause means, you need to read and understand the notes. Well, and they said, similar to all the other standards that ISO 1345 recognizes. Well, there's probably a dozen other standards that they recognize. So it's like these layers of where's FDA going to go in this interpretation and expectation. That's the kind of, you know, great abyss right now in terms of what are inspections going to look like, because, you know, inspections are not based off of just the regulation, but the interpretation and expectation.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right. Last topic here. It's always a fun one. I think we covered this on ours the first time because it's been around forever. And then I had Rob Packard on at some point in time to talk about the MDR. Let me see when I had Rob on. I had Rob on episode 108. So this would have been September of 2022 to talk about MDR. So it's been going on forever. What is the current state of MDR? Where are we at with it? What are some, you know, it feels like there's always we're just delaying the train wreck that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think it's going on right now, but I'm curious, you know, what are some of the major updates? What's going on, status, that kind of thing?
Yep. Well, if we've got T-minus just under 2 months now until the train goes off the rails potentially. Oh, so May 26th, if you are marketing underneath an MDD certificate right now, you are supposed to have an accepted contract with a notified body by May 26th. So in 2 months, if you do not already have an application in process, it's already too late because the application process can take 6 months.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, because they basically audit the application, audit their resources and their qualifications to review your product. It's not just like you're going to, you know, it's not just a business application, if you will, you know. There is a level of diligence that has to be done.
So Michelle, what's the ramifications if, like, you have a product on the market right now and then you don't comply with this? I mean, what happens? It gets taken off the market
you are supposed to take it off the market. It's like having a driver's license and your driver's license expired. You're not supposed to drive the car.
Okay. All right.
And to put it in quantify it for you, the last published numbers I saw towards the end of last year, there were 17,000 MDR or MDD covered products, of which 9,000 had applications. So nearly half had not applied at the end of last year.
So safe to assume some are just either, you know, saying, hey, we're just taking our product off the market in the EU because it doesn't make sense to comply with anymore. and others, I'm guessing that might be a good chunk of them, right? Where they almost kind of just say, hey, you know, we don't have a big enough revenue to care about this. We'll just pull our market. We'll just pull it off. But then I'm guessing another percentage of this are kind of just almost like doubling down and saying, you're not going to take our product off the market if we don't comply or not.
There are a few, but, you know, even you know, some of the biggest companies in the market are taking off 20% of their portfolios that could afford to apply if they wanted to. But, you know, their own market analysis is, especially for commodity products, it just makes no sense. I mean, you're looking at between $200,000 and $500,000 between the review fees, the cost to update your testing, the time it's taken 12 to 18 months. There are so many rate limiting factors that even if you wanted to just say, no, we are going to stay here, just financially, are you shooting yourself in the foot in terms of your profit margin? And what does this mean for commodity products? Who's going to invest in a suture or a wound drain catheter or, you know, some of these things that have been on the market for 40, 50 years that now need all this extra testing, work, trials, et cetera?
Yeah. Yeah, I know the there are, you know, obviously this is something that is forcing people to have very strong opinions one way or the other on kind of what to do with it. And I've been hearing quite a few from some of our connections in Europe, you know, who are pretty upset, you know, by a lot of this. And, there are some, you know, folks who are saying it's stunting the innovation, the growth community there. And, you know, it's hard to disagree with some of that, right? I mean, we've definitely seen a big uptick in, you know, people wanting to take their product not to market in Europe, even though they're innovating in Europe and coming to the US, right? Where before, and I'm sure you remember this too, like, I mean, you know, pre any of this discussion, most people went to market in Europe first and then came to the US. And I think the US was fine with that too. I mean, you kind of went because, you know, there is a huge market here in the US. We also have a different kind of healthcare system than most of Europe. And so it's a little more advantageous for innovators. But, you know, it's just always really interesting. Now this dynamic is like really shifted. And I think that's hurting a lot of I know for sure service providers in Europe, because there's just not as much interest to go there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. That paradigm has totally shifted as far as what markets make sense to go to first. And my business, for clients outside of the US wanting to come to US first has really grown over the last years. And I make the shift. Not even Europe wants to go to Europe anymore.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Awesome. Is there anything else on the MDR, Michelle, that you wanted to touch on? Anything mammoth there besides the fact that we're 2 months away at the time of this recording that, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm just waiting with bated breath to see if the bomb goes off or the train goes off the tracks.
Right.
You know, I just, if it's going to be a matter of, it was public outcry that kind of started all of this, you know, many, many years ago with the PIP breast implant scandal. And so I think it's going to be public outcry when they actually lose access to devices. It's going to drive it back to a place of logic.
Good. Awesome. All right, Michelle, hang on for 1 minute. Again, we'll put the link to LeanRA QA's website in here, Michelle's LinkedIn, which if you don't follow Michelle on LinkedIn, that would be really wise to do because she shares a lot of great information there. And it's funny sometimes. We can include the link to the YouTube channel as well. So you can check out, because I think you also have a video on the eStar program. There's a bunch of great content there. Any other?
And just one more thing. Yeah. I'm finalizing a checklist for the transition to QMSR.
Cool.
So be on the lookout for that.
It'll probably be on my website. Yep. And if you go to Michelle's website too, you can also sign up for the mailing list, and there she'll send you, you know, a lot of these updates as well too. I know I get them. So, yeah, Michelle, thanks for doing this. Hang on for 1 minute. We'll chat offline, but thanks again.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you need anything from us, you can contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. And for more information on Project MedTech, visit our website at www.projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.